Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, supported by Sobi, we had the pleasure of speaking with Aaron T. Gerds, MD, MS, and James K. McCloskey, MD, about myelofibrosis treatment advances. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Gerds and McCloskey discussed factors that influence their choice between the variety of JAK inhibitors that are FDA approved for patients with myelofibrosis, tips for symptom management in this disease, and emerging myelofibrosis research to look out for. So, speaking about navigating myelofibrosis, just to start off, what are some JAK inhibitors that are approved for patients with myelofibrosis, and what patient characteristics or disease factors might help oncologists choose between these agents?
Well, that is a fantastic question. These days, we now have 4 JAK inhibitors that are approved here in the United States to treat patients with myelofibrosis. This has been a really recent development. If we think about the long history of myelofibrosis, going back, you know, to the 1800s when it was first described, to the speculation that there was some sort of commonality among the MPNs, to the discovery of JAK2 mutations recurrent in patients with MPNs, to the approval of ruxolitinib. I mean, that is a long, long, long time. But in just the last few years, we've had 3 other JAK inhibitors approved, with a number of other therapies potentially on the precipice of getting approved and made available for our patients. And some often ask, well, gee, why 4 JAK inhibitors? But I think the key point with all that is they are all different, even though they are in the same class. Those distinguishing features are what help you decide which treatment to give to which patient.
This is an area that's changing really quickly. I think we have more options today than we have ever before. I think just as a reminder to folks listening that the primary objectives for us as oncologists is to address our patients' spleen-related symptoms and cytokine-related symptoms when we're managing their myelofibrosis. And then bear in mind that spleen volume reduction correlates with survival benefits. So, you know, I think that in addition to kind of improving their symptoms, I often consider spleen response to be a marker for improved overall outcomes. So I think that for most of our patients, especially at diagnosis, ruxolitinib is likely to remain our first line therapy. Again, I think it's clearly kind of the standard for patients who have intact counts otherwise. For patients who are not deriving the benefit that I would expect from ruxolitinib, maybe their spleen is not responding appropriately. Maybe they remain symptomatic, but their counts remain high. Maybe they're still proliferative. Then those are the patients who I think after 6 months, I would turn to fedratinib. And I think that in our current arsenal, that's likely the drug that's most often overlooked. But a reminder that if you have patients who are sort of having a suboptimal response, still symptomatic, and still have otherwise intact counts, fedratinib can be a good option for those folks. Once we look at patients as they progress and they're becoming more cytopenic, that's when we think about some of the newer agents. And I think certainly for those patients who are developing anemia, and maybe that anemia is limiting our ability to treat their disease, because as everyone knows, as we treat patients with ruxolitinib, we can see worsening of their anemia. That can either be a function of the drug itself or their disease biology. And that often prompts us to reduce the dose of ruxolitinib. And so for those patients, I think early on in their disease biology, those are people who will often switch to momelotinib. Again, I think that we can see up to 6 months required before we can get a full response. So I try to keep patients on treatment as long as possible. And I try to treat through that initial period of anemia with ruxolitinib, bridge that gap, understanding that the patients will have a more significant decline in their hemoglobin during the first 12 weeks on treatment that often improves or at least plateaus. But I think that if I'm not getting the response I want and the patient's anemic, then that's when I really turn to momelotinib. Now, that being said, if I have a profoundly anemic patient, maybe a frail patient who might have trouble traveling, then momelotinib still might be appropriate for that patient in the frontline setting. And then for patients who have thrombocytopenia, particularly that's when we're going to think about pacritinib. And I would highlight really thrombocytopenia with or without anemia, you know, and in the frontline setting, if I'm starting with platelets less than 50,000, I'll probably reach for pacritinib first. That's not your typical patient. So again, if I see the platelets falling, I see them developing thrombocytopenia with anemia, then I'm certainly going to probably, in my case, turn to pacritinib before momelotinib. And then I think just to take a moment and pause that the NCCN has recognized the potential benefit for patients who have myelofibrosis and anemia to receive pacritinib as well. I mean, we've now done a lot of research to show that pacritinib can likewise inhibit ACVR1 potentially more, or at least potentially the same degree as momelotinib. And so it can be an appealing option there. So I would remind the audience too that, you know, if I have a patient that I've sequenced onto momelotinib, maybe in a second line setting, and I'm not getting the response that I want in terms of their anemia, then I might sequence to pacritinib in that setting as well. And that would be currently supported by your NCCN guidelines.
So the commonality among all the JAK inhibitors is that they all inhibit wild-type JAK2. Not mutant JAK2, but wild-type JAK2. And that's really where the kind of crux and the emphasis of that therapy is. Inhibiting wild-type JAK2 to slow down that signaling pathway that includes STAT and the downstream effects. But they also do other things, like some inhibit JAK1, some inhibit ACVR1, some inhibit FLT3 or other genes like IRAK1 that can have differential effects on what these drugs can do. So we'll start with ruxolitinib, the classic JAK1, JAK2 inhibitor. Doesn't have a lot of effects on other molecules that we know of, and it's been fantastic at shrinking spleens and improving symptoms. And if we look at something a little bit different, like pacritinib, which is a JAK2 inhibitor, doesn't inhibit JAK1, but also has off-target effects on IRAK1, which is a key regulator of the NF-kappa-B pathway and probably has something to do with cytopenias and more myelodysplastic-like disease, as well as ACVR1, which is part of the hepcidin pathway. So by inhibiting ACVR1, it can lower hepcidin levels, relieving anemia of inflammatory block. So it's a JAK2 inhibitor that can shrink spleens, improve symptoms from that direction, but has all these other kind of targets it's hitting and have other benefits for patients for a different population of myelofibrosis than, say, kind of the classic JAK inhibitor, if you will, being ruxolitinib.
What are some patients that might benefit most from allogeneic stem cell transplantation?
Well, when a patient is first diagnosed with myelofibrosis, one of the initial steps is to determine prognosis using one of the prognostic models, such as the DIPSS score or the MIPSS score or the MySecPM, where you take these clinical and pathologic variables and you come up with a predicted survival for that given individual. If the given survival with those models is less than 5 years, then in patients who are otherwise eligible for transplant, we start to see an advantage for transplant over non-transplant therapy, meaning that the initial morbidity and mortality associated with transplantation is overcome by the long-term potential curative potential of that therapy. So really, at the time of diagnosis is the first time you should think about transplant for patients with myelofibrosis. Run the prognostic models. If the survival is shorter, then those patients should be referred at that point in time to transplant to get the HLA typing down and to start teeing things up potentially. That doesn't mean you don't treat their myelofibrosis with a JAK inhibitor in between or whatever appropriate therapy, but you really want to start doing the transplant workup in parallel with the non-transplant therapies. If a given individual's survival by those models is predicted to be longer, you know, 5 years, 10 years, or even longer, then you don't necessarily need to refer them to transplant at that moment. But if any point along the line after that, their disease changes, becomes more aggressive, they're developing new cytopenias, JAK inhibitors no longer controlling their spleen or symptoms, you do then want to think about sending those patients over to the transplanter because, again, transplant is the only therapy that has shown curative potential in patients with myelofibrosis.
All patients really benefit from meeting transplant early in their disease process. I think that most clearly who should go directly to transplant is anyone with intermediate to or high risk disease. I do still feel like it benefits patients to see transplant in the intermediate one risk category as well. I think that in those circumstances, we can often weigh very carefully the pros and cons for patients earlier in the disease biology. And it just helps connect them with a transplant earlier so we sort of know their options. We can kind of, even if we're going to decide to treat them and monitor them for a time period, we sort of have an idea about what their options might be. They are familiar with transplant and they're plugged into the system. I personally find that these intermediate one-risk patients are the most challenging to decide sort of when to pull the trigger on transplant. because these patients particularly have a heterogeneous disease biology, some of them can live for many years with relatively stable disease. And I would highlight that if these patients are receiving treatment and responding well to ruxolitinib, those patients particularly seem to do well. So I think that if we go back to our earlier conversation, if I have an intermediate one risk patient that I'm treating and they're really not responding, then I'm likely to take that patient to transplant earlier. Plugging trace of patients into transplant earlier also helps us sort of identify them earlier in their chronologic age, because as everyone is aware, as our patients get older, transplant gets harder. So I think to address your question, certainly patients that we struggle to take transplant are older patients or patients who have really severe uncontrolled disease. These patients can be particularly challenging to take to transplant.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say about some of the common symptoms of myelofibrosis that oncologists might encounter, or, you know, challenges that might arise for community oncologists when trying to manage these symptoms?
So the most common symptoms of myelofibrosis include the stuff that we put in the MPN-10. So things like fatigue, night sweats, itchy skin, unexplained weight loss, abdominal pain, early satiety, bone pain, and the like. And so we really use the MPN-10 as a starting point. But patients may have other symptoms like, you know, dizziness, Raynaud's-like phenomenon, other microvascular disturbances that you would want to think about, because there are potential interventions that could make those symptoms better. Nonetheless, these symptoms do occur in the everyday population, you know, people who don't have myelofibrosis. So for me, a lot of time, the hardest part is separating out, well, what's truly from the myelofibrosis and what might be due to some other reason or etiology. And so really trying to pull those things apart can be a challenge in clinic every day. But, you know, I think a good place to start is with those symptoms listed in the MPN-10. Again, the fevers, the night sweats, the early satiety, abdominal pain. It's a good place to start thinking about, well, what things are impacting my patient with myelofibrosis, and then working from there. So I think one of the major challenges that comes up in everyday practice in the care of patients with myelofibrosis are the cytopenias, anemia and thrombocytopenia. These things are incredibly common. You know, at the time of diagnosis, roughly 40% of patients will have anemia. And at some point in time, every patient will develop anemia, as well as thrombocytopenia being very, very prevalent as well. And the added challenge is that when you try to use a JAK inhibitor to improve symptoms or splenomegaly or even extend survival to a certain degree, those JAK inhibitors can lower the blood counts and make it even more difficult to continue on with JAK inhibitor therapy. So, you know, you look really for that benefit, but, you know, we're also sometimes tied down by the cytopenias. And we do have therapies that can treat anemia. We have erythropoiesis-stimulating agents, luspatercept, danazol, that can be anemia-directed therapies. We now have JAK inhibitors with anemia benefit that inhibit ACVR1, like momelotinib and pacritinib. But, you know, it's still very difficult to rectify one's anemia. And when you turn to thrombocytopenia, there are fewer effective agents at improving thrombocytopenia. So it's really, really a challenge. One, because, you know, you run into transfusions, which can be burdensome to patients. Two, it's prognostically negative. The presence of anemia and thrombocytopenia are associated with a negative survival or worsened survival in patients with myelofibrosis. And lastly, it does limit our ability to do JAK inhibitor therapy. So for all those reasons, it's a really difficult challenge within the care of these patients.
One of the most challenging things is often trying to separate disease-related symptoms from symptoms related maybe to the drug, toxicities from the drug, and symptoms related to anemia. I really find that latter issue to be the most challenging to distinguish. For instance, fatigue is one of the most common cytokine-related symptoms that we see in myelofibrosis. And it can be really challenging to tease apart whether or not that patient's fatigue is related to their disease in terms of the cytokine-mediated phenomenon, or if their symptoms might be related to their anemia, because they look exactly the same. So I've had over the years, for instance, patients who feel better, slightly more anemic, because their disease-related symptoms are being controlled than they do if we pull back on the drug and their anemia actually improves. So I think that's really the most challenging thing to tease apart for me. I think one of the things we can do to really make that easier and improve early recognition of symptoms is to encourage dialogues with our patients. Really, I think that, you know, when I meet patients at the beginning of their journey, I sort of highlight the symptoms we're going to be looking out for. And obviously, everyone knows we have symptom calculators that can be used for research purposes. And we can use them in our day-to-day practice, but they're not always so reflective of what is going on in our patients' day-to-day life. And I find that patients sometimes struggle to fill them out. So I think it's often easiest just to talk to our patients and proactively address symptoms so that we can address them earlier in the disease process.
What patient characteristics or disease factors are prognostic in myelofibrosis, and how do these factors influence your treatment decisions?
So there are a variety of sort of red flags that we can look out for. And there are a few different risk calculators that can be used in our approach to risk stratification of myelofibrosis. One of the greatest benefits to our current risk stratifying calculators is really that they're all intended to be dynamic. So that's really helpful by contrast to something like MDS, where those are sort of static snapshots in times. The calculators we've developed in myelofibrosis are dynamic so that we can use those calculators at diagnosis. We can turn back to those calculators 5 years in the disease process and do our best at least to estimate how the disease might behave. And so I think that there's a variety available. I think there's most commonly DIPSS and then DIPSS Plus and now MIPSS, the latter of which incorporates molecular data. But I think there's a few really easy red flags for clinicians that are not rocket science. So number one, anytime our patients are developing cytopenias, and this is a high risk feature. So anytime your hemoglobin drops less than 10 or your platelets less than 100, this is a big red flag. And that's usually enough, depending on the patient's age, to tip them into the intermediate two or high risk category. And again, that should prompt referral to a transplant physician. We should be on the lookout for blasts in the peripheral blood. And I think that one of the things we struggle with in that regard is that I think, especially in the community, we often think about bone marrows as being important in staging the myeloid malignancies, which is certainly true if there's something changing clinically. But in myelofibrosis, leukemogenesis really does occur in the spleen. So we should be looking in the peripheral blood for blasts. And anytime we see those in our manual diff, it should prompt evaluation. We do peripheral blood flow cytometry twice a year in our patients with this disease. And then in that same regard, splenic enlargement is an important marker for disease progression and a decline in survival. If anything that I see in my clinic, this is the most commonly missed manifestation of the disease. I think that in a busy clinic, maybe if the patient's body habitus makes it difficult, we can kind of neglect the spleen. And I think, to be fair, the NCCN and even international guidelines haven't given us good recommendations on serial imaging and the role of, sort of repeated ultrasound in these patients. So for us, we do an ultrasound at least once a year, maybe twice a year. And anytime there's a change in the disease progress or the clinical presentation. Lastly, the use of molecular testing in these patients has really become standardized. So there's a variety of higher risk mutations that can be observed in these patients. Obviously, our triple negative patients with ASXL1 mutations, P53 mutations, and others that really highlight higher risk molecular subtypes. And I think, again, if we see the patient's disease characters exchanging, that's a time to reevaluate their molecular signature to re-risk stratify them.
Looking to the future, what are some emerging therapies for myelofibrosis that your colleagues should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of themes that are emerging. One, well, is the treatment of anemia. And I already mentioned luspatercept in an earlier response. And there is an ongoing phase 3 trial with luspatercept in myelofibrosis. And the phase 2 trial was recently published. And there is certainly activity there in terms of improving patients' anemia. We also are looking at two randomized prospective trials done in the frontline setting that have reported out recent results. One with a combination of ruxolitinib and navitoclax, a BCL2, BCLX inhibitor, and one with ruxolitinib plus a BET inhibitor called pelabresib. And both trials were positive for their primary endpoint, and we're in that period now where we're looking for secondary endpoints to come through, durability of response and depth of response type of analyses. And so, we eagerly await that data. The imetelstat randomized phase 3 trial is ongoing and will hopefully finish accrual soon, as well as many other earlier phase trials that are ongoing. For example, a monoclonal antibody directed against mutant calreticulin protein, which is very exciting. It offers the possibility of the rituximab, if you will, for myelofibrosis, which I think a drug that has significant clinical activity with minimal toxicity would be attractive, not only as a single agent, but certainly in combination therapies as well. So lots going on in myelofibrosis, and there are a lot of therapies that are teetering on the brink of being available, as well as some really exciting things a little bit further down on the horizon.
You know, we saw really impressive data from both pelabresib and navitoclax, where we saw a nearly doubling of spleen response with the addition of these agents to ruxolitinib in the frontline setting, but less than impressive improvement in total symptom score reduction. So basically, with both these drugs, the spleen response was twice as robust, but we didn't really see an improvement in symptoms score burden for patients with frontline treatment. And I think that prompted a lot of dialogue about what does that mean. And I think personally, I feel that we're really in need of different tools to measure responses in patients in the frontline setting or in the combination setting, where everyone's getting Rux, which is very good at reducing symptoms. It may be, in my opinion, that total symptom score calculators and these sort of subjective calculators are not the best tools to really accurately measure and objectively measure symptoms. But the fact that these drugs did not achieve a reduction in symptom score by 50% or more could be a stumbling block, certainly will be a stumbling block, I think, for navitoclax, which has been pulled from clinical development. Fortunately, pelabresib has other data to support a clinical benefit, and they do have data as an add-on to ruxolitinib as well. So I think that pelabresib is likely to be a drug that we will see come to market. The other drug in clinical development where we're waiting on phase 3 data to mature is imetelstat, which everyone's aware was just approved in myelodysplastic syndrome. So that study, which is powered for overall survival, will be one that we are anxiously awaiting. We have ongoing phase 3 studies looking at drugs being added to ruxolitinib. One of those showing promise is selinexor, a drug that is approved in multiple myeloma. So we're going to be watching that closely. And I think in some ways, as an investigator, I will say that the closing of one door may open another. And I think that's certainly the case in the failure of navitoclax and possibly, depending on how you skew the data, pelabresib really to change the upfront landscape significantly. There's a host of other trials opening add-on studies for the frontline setting, including immunotherapy such as PIM inhibitors. So there's several kind of closer in development that I think we're still excited about. But I think, you know, the failure of these studies, Ash, really underscores the difficulty in doing research on this very rare disease with these secondary endpoints that are, you know, in some ways surrogates for survival, but are attempted to really measure disease-related symptom burden reduction. It can just be really challenging when that's the endpoints that we've set forth with the FDA. You know, I've been at Hackensack for 10 years now, and I've been the director of the leukemia division maybe for 5, but I really started out as the director of the MPN program. And I think sort of these orphan diseases, these underdogs have always been near and dear to my heart. And I think that I can't emphasize enough the importance of continuing to try to do clinical research on these rare diseases. And I think that at Hackensack, we've really built really valuable and rewarding relationships with our referring physicians. But if any physicians listening to this across the country and they have the opportunity to collaborate with a tertiary center, every single patient that can go on to a myelofibrosis study is really a tremendous leap forward. I mean, there are certain trials, if we can only put one study on per institution, that's a huge achievement. I think that, you know, the luspatercept study is a great example. We ended up with a handful of patients in that study and ended up being one of the top accruers in the country, I think the top accruing site potentially. And it sort of underscores how difficult it is to get patients onto these trials. Certainly at a place like Hackensack, we're really grateful to work with any community physician that has patients with rare diseases. And we do our best now to often limit their visits and the need for transportation. Some of these visits now can be telehealth. And so I think that to offer patients new treatments for a disease that can be so challenging to manage is really important.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, supported by Sobi. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OnClive On Air.